This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
No, I mean, they're getting... Basically, we do what we can with what we have where we are, but it's far from adequate.
That's Yasmin Sharif, Executive Director of the Education Cannot Wait Fund, on whether the children in Chad's refugee camps are getting the support they need. Details coming up. Also, the African Climate Summit ends with a call for a global carbon tax on fossil fuels, aviation, and maritime transport. And why are military takeovers in Francophone countries becoming common? We'll have an answer. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The first African Climate Summit has ended today with a call for world leaders to rally behind a global carbon tax on fossil fuels, aviation, and maritime transport. It also seeks reform of the world financial system that forces African nations to pay more to borrow money and fall deeper into debt. The Associated Press says the unanimous declaration is backed by the leaders of the continent of 1.3 billion people, a population set to double by 2050. It calls on the world's biggest emitters of greenhouse gases and its richest countries to keep their promises, especially the unfulfilled pledge of a $100 billion annually in climate finance to developing nations. The declaration also calls for Africa's vast mineral wealth to be processed on the continent. On the final day of the first Africa Climate Summit, leaders from across the continent rallied support for quick action to ease climate change and its impact. The three-day summit in Nairobi under the theme Driving Green Growth and Climate Finance Solutions for Africa and the World concluded today with a Nairobi declaration on climate change and a call to action. Reporter Ruben Chama spoke with Brian Onyango, the founder of USAFI Green Energy, which manufactures and supplies affordable, low-carbon cook stoves in Kenya's Kakuma refugee camp, creating work and improving health for displaced people and host communities. The company is among the finalists for the 2023 Ashden Awards, pioneers delivering low-carbon solutions in their communities.
We provide clean energy solutions. In particular, we manufacture clean cookstoves and clean fuel called the briquettes. Our aim is to target the refugees in Kakuma and the marginalized community in Turkana, whereby we provide them the alternative clean energy solution, mostly the cooking solution.
Why is it important to involve these marginalized communities in tackling issues of climate change and coming up with these innovative solutions?
Basically, as we know, Turkana is one of the poorest counties in Kenya. I personally, I was raised in Nairobi, but following my interventions and movement in Turkana, I saw there was a huge gap and need to address the lack of clean cooking in that solution. So our aim is to try to empower this marginalized community, provide something alternative so that they can also have a resounding voice when it comes to adopting to clean or climate environmental products.
What are some of your key takeaways in this conference? What are some of the solutions coming out of this conference?
Our key takeaway is that we are more proud to see our president is spearheading the conversation on clean energy, and we aim to leverage on this. Last year at COP, we were talking about a lot of loss of damage and decarbonization, mostly being affected by the global south. And our aim is to have a one resounding voice whereby we can advocate more of climate change, because Global South normally get more heat. And our plan is to engage stakeholders, work with private sector, work with the governments, so as to try to leverage and introduce what is alternative solution do we have in regards to the climate change, whereby in Kenya already the president have gotten some intervention whereby we plant trees. We go green when it comes to windmills and even hydropower generation. So that's the way to go.
You are among the finalists of this year's Ashden Award. What does that kind of international recognition mean to you?
Being a finalist of this year award is a resounding win for us, especially we have applied this application twice, and this was our third attempt, because we really feel that our story also deserves to be acknowledged and recognized, because you are in the deepest marginalized community, tackling both refugees and host community. And being named as the finalist, we feel that is a win to the Kakuma people and to the Kakuma family. And we look forward to share our story with all partners who might want to work with us, engage us, or even partner with us.
That was Brian Onyango, the founder of USAFI Green Energy, which manufactures and supplies affordable, low-carbon cook stoves in Kenya's Kakuma refugee camp, speaking with VOA's Ruben Chama from Nairobi. More than 50 aid organizations are backing search and rescue groups fighting Italian authorities, who they say are deliberately assigning remote ports to disembark rescued migrants. Italian authorities say they're simply overwhelmed by the number of arriving migrants. Reporter Elijah Volkman recently spent time aboard a rescue ship and has this report from Tunis.
The number of people taking boats from Libya and Tunisia across the Mediterranean has risen sharply this year. The boats they use often run into distress, requiring rescue. This year, the Italian Coast Guard has rescued at least 80,000 people at sea. Aid organizations have rescued about 5,400. Search and rescue organizations say Italy has been ordering their ships to disembark migrant survivors in ports far from the Mediterranean migration routes, such as Ancona on the Adriatic Sea. Sarah is the chief officer of the search and rescue ship Humanity One, operated by the German group SOS Humanity, which asks that no last names of their workers are used for safety reasons. Sarah recounts her experience.
This rotation, both of our rescue operations were assigned a distant port. Both of these ports were at least 4 days' sail from our area of operation. We are never given a reason. We are just told to proceed to the port of safety at the maximum sustainable speed. And since I have been working for SOS Humanity, I have only ever experienced distant ports, with no offer of a closer one or no explanation as to why. This practice of the assignment of distant ports began in December last year. Every NGO vessel is experiencing this. Since then, all NGO SAR vessels have been assigned more than 50 ports which were unnecessarily far away from the locations where the rescues were conducted. For us, every time we rescue, this means that we're wasting 8 days of sailing. This is 8 days where we could be in the area of operation rescuing people. It's also 8 days of fuel, which is costing a lot of money, and this is a big issue for NGOs as they rely on donations.
To manage arrivals, Italy set up 4 southern ports of reception, or hotspots, and where they are full, Italian authorities say they send aid organisations' rescue ships to other ports. The spokesperson for the Italian Ministry for the Interior says this policy isn't an attempt to obstruct rescue groups. The spokesperson for the Italian Ministry for the Interior says this policy isn't an attempt to obstruct rescue groups. In an email to Voice of America, the spokesperson said the aid organization ships are sent to other ports when the 4 hotspots are full. The spokesperson also said the government simply is trying to regulate the rescues. Rescue groups say that since Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni was elected last year, their once good relations with Italian authorities have deteriorated. SOS Humanity has filed lawsuits against the Italian authorities. Their advocacy officer, Marie, explains.
International maritime law clearly states that the responsible rescue coordination centres have to ensure that people rescued from distress disembark in a place of safety as soon as possible.
Janet is an emergency room doctor volunteering on Humanity One and says the longer travel time affects the health of those rescued.
Oh, the long journeys have a very significant impact. They already arrive in a very fragile state. We do what we can to feed them, to rehydrate them, to care for them, but conditions on the boat aren't ideal. They, particularly if the weather isn't good or if it's particularly hot weather for prolonged times. And it just adds to the suffering that these people really shouldn't be put through.
Rescue groups say that despite the tensions with the authorities, it is the Italian Coast Guard that is increasingly calling on their ships to assist in rescues as the number of migrant boats in distress continues to rise. For Voice of America Africa, I'm Alicia Folkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield announced today nearly $163 million in additional humanitarian assistance for the people of Sudan and neighboring countries during her visit to Chad. The U.S. State Department said the aid includes nearly $103 million provided through the State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration and nearly $60 million through the U.S. Agency for International Development Bureau for Humanitarian Assistance. This brings total U.S. humanitarian assistance for the emergency response to about $710 million in the current fiscal year for Sudan, Chad, Egypt, Ethiopia, South Sudan, and the Central African Republic. The State Department says the U.S. is the largest single donor addressing the humanitarian crisis sparked by the conflict between Sudan's military and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. The help includes food, shelter, access to health care, water, sanitation, and hygiene supplies, along with support for communities throughout the region hosting Sudanese refugees and welcoming returnees. More than 24.7 million people in Sudan are in need of humanitarian assistance. In Nigeria, a court panel today has dismissed many of the challenges regarding the election of President Bola Tinubu, which the People's Democratic Party and the Labour Party had filed. Among their findings, the judges dismissed the Labour Party candidate Peter Obi's allegation that the election was rigged in Tinubu's favour. The court, however, has not yet read its verdict, and the challenge from Atiku Abubakar, the candidate of the People's Democratic Party. The hearing has been going on for several hours as the judges read their extensive findings. The Abuja court has been deliberating since June over dozens of allegations of irregularities in the election of the president and several state governors and senators. The court building is surrounded by heavy security. A report at the court tells VOA there is no significant crowd outside as police are limiting access to only accredited journalists and people approved to be in the area. A small group of women nearby hold signs supporting Tinubu, who leads the All Progressive Congress. We'll be updating this story on voaafrica.com and all your favorite VOA news programs. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. While diplomats try to quickly restore democratically elected governments in Africa that have been ousted in a recent rash of coups, major questions loom on the continent. Why are military takeovers in Francophone countries becoming common? And why is Russia's Wagner mercenary group ready to support the new military juntas? Professor John Mukum Mbaku is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. I spoke with him recently, and he said in countries like former French colonies Niger and Gabon, there is a great sense of frustration and people are looking to the military to resolve critical and difficult governance problems. But he doubts that the military way is the solution.
But what we have to keep in mind is that the military's overconfidence and perhaps a certain level of arrogance that they and they alone have the right answers to these serious problems is misplaced. The military doesn't have the answer to these problems. It has the gun. The military has the gun and is able to seize control of government.
Mbaku says military leaders often speak with certainty that they can rescue their countries from foreign exploitation, extreme poverty, corruption, nepotism, and rampant violence that exist in these countries. But throughout the past seven decades, he says, the military has shown failure in governance in several African nations.
The military have not been able to supply any better solutions than the ones that were supplied by the civilian regimes. And so I think that it is not appropriate for us to continue to look up to the military. The key for developing African countries lies in a trust in the people, a trust in the development of institutions that are undergirded by the rule of law.
According to Mbaku, those institutions do not have to be the same as the ones in the Western nations. Nevertheless, he says, they should have some level of the rule of law. He says, the people of Francophone Africa now see the Russians, including the mercenary Wagner group, as a better alternative than the French. He points out that there is no guarantee that the Russians wouldn't come in and do the same thing the French have been accused of doing, such as exploiting resources and ignoring civilian concerns.
Because the Russians are in Africa doing the looking for minerals, looking for resources, looking for gold, looking for an opportunity to enrich themselves, just as much as the Western powers have done during the last several years. So I think that development in Africa must be based on African solutions for African problems.
The British government today designated Wagner as an international terrorist organization, while the United States has designated it a transnational organized crime group. In our conversation, Professor Mbaku suggested that instead of military leadership, African countries should look to ECOWAS and other regional organizations to provide structure. He also says they should improve their governance institutions and economies through regional cooperation and trade with neighboring countries. Algerian Foreign Minister Ahmed Attaf says he discussed his country's initiative to ease the Niger crisis with Assistant Secretary of State of African Affairs Moli Fee. He said agreement was reached on three main principles: respect for the constitutional and democratic order, restoration of President Bazoum, and a solution for the conflict in the Sahel country. William Lawrence, professor of international relations at the American University in Washington, discussed the U.S. position on the Algerian initiative with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The U.S. already gave credence to the Algerian initiative, but it was very interesting. Blinken met with Attaf in Washington, and it looked like the Americans were teaming up with the Algerians. And of course, Moli Fee went to Algiers, but the U.S. statements are not supporting Algeria per se, they're supporting ECOWAS. Now, I find it remarkable that when the Americans go to Niamey, they get the meetings they want, including with the head of the junta. But just after that happens, they kicked out the U.S. ambassador. So what it seems like is the Putschists don't really know how to do this or exactly who they want to leave, i.e. the French, and who they want to stay, i.e. the Americans and others. And it seems sort of like political amateur hour, that they're making it up as they go along, which lowers their credibility. So the U.S. preference for the Algerian-type solution is correct, but when they say they support ECOWAS, what they're saying is they support a military option as a last resort, whereas the Algerians view the military option as a highly undesirable outcome on ideological grounds and political grounds. So we won't have an acceptable or optimal or sustainable solution to the project if the goals are completely different. And I'm arguing that the Algerian and the ECOWAS goals are different. So what it comes down to is, do you want just stability or do you want democracy, even if it involves conflict? Because a peaceful way back to democracy doesn't seem to be possible. And Putschists don't listen to peaceful crowds that aren't even protesting, right? Putschists listen to shows of force. So I would say that the Algerian approach might work if there was a large ECOWAS army mobilized on several borders outside Niger and poised to attack imminently. The Algerian approach might work, but not in a vacuum. No, the solution, I think, is to target the sanctions not on the whole Nigerian population, but just on the leaders, which hasn't been done yet. Understand that Bazoum won't be reinstated. So when we talk about Bazoum, stop talking about him being reinstated and talk about him being released from house arrest and allowed to leave the country. And then talk about a short transition period to new democratic leadership. And then the international community, along with Algeria and everyone else, has to address the elephants in the room, which is, number one, how are we going to fight terrorists? And how can the international community help in a better way? And two, what happens to the uranium and oil wealth of Niger? And will it be better distributed to the people? And that thereby you're dealing with the grievances of those Nigerians that are supporting the coup. But the Algerian approach isn't addressing any of those structural issues. It's just talking about not having ECOWAS come in.
The coup leader was inaugurated as a new transitional president and promised a fair and transparent elections, but did not specify when. What do you make of that?
That they want to stay in power as long as possible, that they want to consolidate power, and they want to prevent the ECOWAS intervention and get the French pushed out of the way in the meantime. So it's all about power. Then what do? You step down, you hold elections, or do you consolidate your power? Often putschists are so busy consolidating their power for the medium term and preventing counter coups or coups within coups or other sorts of power grabs that they don't move towards the democratic outcomes that is the preference of the international community fast or even ever. And when it does happen, it's often years later, which is the scenario the putschists are proposing. So none of that indicates to me that there's any desire to entertain the Algerian approach or any other approach. And again, previously, until they think they need to save face, they won't try to save face by entertaining, a shorter transition period or stepping down from power. But at this point, the putschists in Niger just see themselves as the winners with a mandate from the crowds that are in the street and no pressure to go in any other direction than the direction they're in, they're going in right now.
That was William Lawrence, professor of international relations at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehigis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokvilia Baro, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can.